Right.
Right.
Jeremy, I'm alcoholic. happy to be here tonight. It's been quite a few years since I've been here. I've spoken here probably three or four times over the years. And the first time Billy asked me to come, I think he planned it this way, but that's all right, because it was probably one of the most peaceful journeys I've had driving out here. It was just snow, and I come down and come into the meeting. There was a couple inches out there, and after the meeting, it was probably about 6 inches of snow on the ground. And but it was really nice. You know, I love driving out this way. I get out here sometimes for work, and it's always very peaceful and calming just to be out, you know, in the mountains and the countryside and stuff. And anything away from the city of Richmond, I tell you, man. Anyway, my sobriety date is September the 17th of 2000, and I have a sponsor. I spoke to him this past Friday. I have a new sponsor, actually, just here in the past couple months. My sponsor the past 15 years passed away a few months ago from brain cancer. And that was tough, man. I'm be honest with you. I'm in a really, really tough spot in life right now. And it's been very dark. It's been very lonely. And it's just not been good. It's not where I imagined myself, where I thought I would be at 25 years sober, I can tell you that. And then, you know, with my sponsor passing, it was just, you know, another layer on top of that of another loss in my life. And my sponsor, my former sponsor, Bob, he was like a father to me and really walked me through some really dark periods throughout my sobriety over the past 15 years and some really troubling times, and helped me to get to where I was and where I'm at currently today in life without a drink. So anyway, I'm gonna tell you a little bit about what I was like, what happened, and what it's like today as a result of taking the 12 steps, applying them in my life when I'm willing to apply them in my life. There's a big difference in needing this program and actually doing this program. It's a huge difference, and being willing to do it. And there's a lot of where I'm at with you know, where I'm at right now in life. I have something else that has plagued me, an obsession and compulsion, an outside issue that I'm struggling with. And I've just not reached a point of surrender with it yet. You know, this is Alcoholics Anonymous, so I'm going to stick to my drinking and my alcoholism, but there's a lot that goes along with that, you know, and these things, if I don't stay vigilant every single day in 10, 11, and 12 and open and honest with my sponsor and people that I'm close to, little things creep in and little things take over. And I realize yet again how powerless I am over my alcoholism. And you take away the alcohol and I'm still left with I, self, and me. The ego is still there. The pride's still there. The arrogance is still there. And the next thing you know, like, I'm easing God out of my life and I'm grasping a hold of this, I'm grasping a hold of that, anything to make me feel whole on the inside yet again, just not drugs and alcohol. And that's what's happened. It was a slow process, but when it hit, I just went all in. So anyway, I got drunk for the first time. I have a home group also. It's very important in Alcoholics Anonymous to have a home group. You know, I used to think I was never homeless because I never really slept on the street, you know, like a night or two here or there at somebody's lawn chair or something in the backyard, but just because I couldn't go home. But I never considered myself without a home. And I tell you how delusional I can be is, you know, I was in Alcoholics Anonymous for a good number of years before I realized that if I'm incarcerated, I'm homeless. So I was homeless because I was incarcerated for a little while. And so anyway, I have a home, and I'm not homeless in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've always had a home group in AA. We are actually getting ready to have our second anniversary coming up on October the 15th. My home group is the Gift of Desperation, the GOD group. And we meet in Richmond Wednesday nights at 7 o'clock. We have a rotating format, and we have babysitting at our meeting too. And you know, it's really cool because and I won't go through all the details of how the meeting took, how it got set up and took place, but it was absolutely God working behind the scenes to make sure that we had a place to hold our meeting and had what we wanted, what we were looking for. You know, the church has babysitters there on Wednesday nights for the choir group, and they said, absolutely, you can use our babysitters. And we started off with needing one babysitter, and I think there's like three or four of them up there now, you know, between the AA kids and the choir kids. And it's great because AA kids, I don't know if any of you have been into a meeting that's just a lot of AA kids in the babysitting room. It's pretty wild and crazy. So it's good for those AA kids to be in a room with some church, you know, church family kids to kind of mellow it out, even it out a little bit there. You know what I mean? Good for them to have that interaction, I guess. But anyway, so that's been my home group now for 2 years. We started that meeting 2 years ago, and I tell you, it's probably the best home group I feel like I've been a part of since I've been sober, and I've been a part of, I think, four. And so anyway, I got drunk for the first time at 12 years old, and what alcohol did for me at that time was it quieted my mind down, and I didn't know that I needed my mind to quiet down. I just believed at that point the way that my mind worked was normal. I believed that everyone thought the way that I thought and felt the way that I felt, even though I did feel like I was different. My earliest memories, I just felt, you know, kind of inadequate, out of place, very, very afraid of other people. Like I wasn't the kid that went to school and just like made a ton of friends out on the playground in kindergarten. You know, I'm the kid that like, you know, was hugging onto my mom's leg and like crying because I didn't want her to leave me, you know, my first day of school, probably the first day every day for a month, probably. But at that time, I was, you know, I started school short, you know, my father left and walked out and just had a lot of fear. And I didn't know where that came from. I didn't understand that at that age. And, you know, over the next couple of years, like, you know, my dad left and disowned me and didn't have any contact with my brother for a few years because he was living with my dad and I was with my mom. My mom remarried my stepdad, and I consider my stepdad to be my father today because he's the man that raised me. He raised me as his own son, you know. However, and it wasn't perfect. There was a lot of physical abuse in the home, a lot of mental abuse in the home. But one thing I know today is that my parents did the best job that they could. You know, but one of the issues that I had, you know, that with this thinking thing that I have going on is feeling like I'm not good enough. You know, it's just like internally, it's like no matter what, I'm just not good enough. And, you know, and I had evidence of that, you know, right? When I was young, I was like 6 years old, my dad walked out, and didn't have anything to do with me, disowned me, and didn't have any contact with me for a number of years. And then I've got a stepfather that physically abuses me, and then I got a mother that keeps me in this abusive, violent home. And I'm thinking to my, and these are the same people that, in my mind, are supposed to be the people that love me the most and keep me safe and protected. And they tell me they love me all the time, but I just don't see that. I just don't feel that. So I got a lot of stuff going on up here in this head of mine. A lot of confusion. And I didn't go to church. I wasn't a regular church member growing up, but I have some family members that were into the church and really religious. And one of my aunt Linda, she went every Sunday, and I would go with her and my cousins sometimes. And one thing I remember about the church was, you know, in the beginning, you go in and they got the organ playing, and they usually start with the choir singing a few songs or whatever. And during that time, my head would get quiet. My body would get tingly inside. And sometimes I'd get a little emotional. The moment the music stopped, all that went away. It was gone. My head got loud again. I started thinking again. I started listening to your preacher. And I just couldn't get on board with what was happening, you know, what he was saying, what they were reading and stuff. One, because I didn't understand it. But even at a young age, the ego was already in place because I formed my own ideas of what I was reading in the Bible and to form my own ideas of what these people were telling me. And my ideas were not in line with what they were telling me and trying to teach me. So even at that young age, 7, 8, 9 years old, like the ego was already there, the self-centeredness, if you will. And I didn't ever look at it like that, you know, back then or understand any of that stuff. So I've always believed in some sort of creator, spirit of the universe, whatever you want to call it. I've just never believed it had anything to do with my life here today. Because if it did, if this power, if this God was so loving and so powerful that you said, why were these things happening to me? Why did my dad walk out and not want to keep me as his son and be a father? Why did my stepfather physically abuse me? Why did my mother keep me in this, violent environment? Like, why couldn't, what did I do? Why did I didn't deserve this? Just all these thoughts going through my head. So when I got drunk for the first time at the age of 12, like, it quieted all that down. And I was able to just breathe and feel okay. And my head got quiet, my body got tingly and numb, and I was able to laugh. I was able to fit in, and I was able to be in the present moment. I was with two buddies of mine, a guy named Glenn and a guy named Jeff. We'd moved to this neighborhood in Virginia Beach called Green Run, and back then, like, skateboarding was really big, and I was big into skateboarding, and those guys were big into skateboarding. And we skated all over the place. And we got one of the guys said, "Let's get drunk," and I said, "Yes, let's get drunk." I'd never been drunk before. But I've seen people drunk. Like, my family drank. I've been around family events and stuff, and everybody's drinking. They're laughing. They're having a great time. I knew drinking was for the adults. It wasn't for the kids or whatever. But I just felt like, yes, let's get drunk. So we got somebody to go in 7-Eleven and buy us a 12-pack of Budweiser. We went and sat some woods behind a Pizza Hut on Lanhaven Parkway, and we drank those beers, and we had four beers apiece. And I just remember in that moment feeling okay. It was like almost like for the first time in my life, I just felt okay. And I felt like on the inside, I felt like I perceived that those guys looked on the outside. And I always looked at people on the outside and I compared how I felt on the inside to how you looked on the inside. And I judged you on that. And if I felt like you looked better than I felt, then you were better than me. And if I felt like you didn't look that good, then I felt like I was better than you, regardless of what was going on. And I didn't, I went home and I was worried about my mom finding out, smelling it on my breath, whatever. So I just went upstairs and went in my room, and I went and took a shower, and I just went to bed. And I didn't wake up the next morning like thinking about doing that again. That just wasn't my experience. And I was 12 years old at that time. Now, over the next couple of years, anytime somebody said, mentioned drinking, that would set something off in my mind, and I'd get really excited about it. Whether it was 7 o'clock in the morning at the bus stop, or whether it was a Friday night for the football game, or it was over the weekend, spending the night at somebody's house, or whatever it was, and it was nothing for Jeff or Glenn or I to bring it up early in the morning and talk about it. And one of us, typically it was me, would go to 7-Eleven, get a bottle of Great Mad Dog, shove it down our pants, and walk out and proceed to drink that before school. And there were mornings I'd go to school and pass out in first bell, and couldn't even tell you what happened in class. There were times I'd take that bottle and keep it in my locker at school and sip on it throughout the day. There was one time we stole a bottle. Me and some friends were planning on staying after school for a wrestling match, and I got the bottle that morning. It sat in my locker all day, man. Ain't nothing like walking around on the ball field with a hot bottle of Great Mad Dog. And I drank probably three quarters of that bottle, and my buddies got mad at me and made me go down to 7-Eleven and steal another one for them. And ended up going into the wrestling match, and I started to feel a little sick. So I went to the bathroom, and I ended up passing out in the boys' bathroom during the wrestling match. And I managed to come to right towards the end and get back out to the gymnasium right before the last match. And what I remember about that is, as I'm walking down the floor in front of the bleachers, all my friends are down at the end, and they're all sitting, and they're all laughing and pointing, and I just wanted the attention. I just felt seen for once, and I felt accepted and okay. And that's what alcohol gave me. It gave me a feeling of feeling okay, a sense of ease and comfort, a sense of being seen, and being a part of and being one. And had you told me then, where I was going to be in another 6 years, if I continued to drink, I would have laughed at you and said, "There's no way," and, but fast forward from that first drunk at the age of 12 until 6 years later, graduating high school, 18 years old. By that time, I'm a daily drinker. I'm failing my classes, and I through the ninth grade, I was a straight A and B honor roll student. I didn't have problems in school educational wise. I had disciplinary problems in school because I have an ego and a very defined of authority. I don't like being told what to do, even by authority figures. And at the age of 18, senior in high school, I was getting drunk on a daily basis. I somehow managed to graduate, and I graduated in June of 94. And I just, in Bill's story, where he talks about feeling like he's arrived. I was 18 years old. I'm out of high school. I just felt like I was on top of the world. You couldn't tell me anything. I could do what I want now. Never mind the fact that I'm living at home with my parents still. I still feel like I can do what I want. And my parents had a rule that, because my dad worked a lot. I mean, he worked a lot, double shifts. He had a family before he and my mother got together. So he had three daughters he was, taking care of, and then our family too. And my brother ended up coming back to live with us. There was a lot of tension in the home with surrounding that. And I have an younger sister that's 8 years younger than I am. So he was trying to support both, the household and stuff. And my mom worked part-time on and off a little bit here and there. And we didn't have much, but my parents made sure that we always had everything that we needed and a lot of what we wanted, a lot of what we wanted. And I'm very materialistic, and my parents, like, they, these $100 tennis shoes coming out, and my parents are like, no way, man. It was like, we'll pay $50. If you want something that's over $50, you pay the rest. And by the time when I was, 16 years old, my dad, I mean, I had a job. I had a job at 16 years old. My dad had me working with him doing side work. He worked for the Virginia Natural Gas, a gas company down in Norfolk, and did a lot of side work on weekends and stuff like that. I remember being 10, 11, 12 years old underneath the house, busting block, running duct work. Like, my dad taught me at a very young age. I was 9 years old pushing a lawnmower around the neighborhood. He taught me the value of a dollar. He said, don't ever expect anything for free. If you want something, you work hard for it, and he taught me a good work ethic. So my dad worked a lot, and he was a good provider for us. Wasn't much there on the emotional side. The sides that I got to see was just kind of normal being there. And then I got to see the anger, and the rage. And that was about it. Every now and then there was, I'm not saying there wasn't any laughter or whatever, fun times it was, but mostly that's what I saw, just kind of average every day or the anger. So anyway, I managed to graduate high school at 18 years old in June. And at this point, I'm drinking every day. And now I'm out of school. I don't have anything to hold me back. I'm working in this restaurant, and the restaurant business is great for somebody like me because, there's a lot of drinking and drugging in the restaurants. It just is. And when I worked at, in particular, the one of the owners, the son, he was young. He was a little bit younger, and he liked to party, and he liked to do some other things outside of drinking. And he introduced me to another substance, and I started to run on that stuff for a little while too. But anyway, I graduated high school and was out and didn't really have any plans to go to college or anything like that. Like, I knew I needed to do something, so I went down and I was going to sign up at a place called Tidewater Tech or something like that. It was like a computer science little. It was a trade school. It was a tech school is what it was. And I had an appointment on a Monday morning to go down there, Monday, no, November the 7th, I believe, at 9 a.m. And November the 6th, I was at Sunday, I was out with friends. We've been drinking all day and smoking weed and watching football. And, just a normal day for us. Like, we just hung out usually on the weekends, and all of us just drank and watched football. And we ended up going to this pool hall that night, and we had a few drinks there, played some pool, and I got in a verbal altercation with the manager there. And at this point, like, the guys I was hanging out with on the street, like, everybody I hung out with was a little few was a little bit older than I was, and guys were running the streets and living the street life basically. And those are guys I looked up to. That's I wanted to be one of those tough guys, and I'm just not a tough guy until you give me alcohol. And then I think I'm a tough guy, but I'm not really a tough guy. So I'm running around with these guys, and I'm starting to get, a little aggressive when I drank and a little violent when I drank. And I had a verbal altercation with this manager at this pool hall, and it carried over out to the parking lot. There's a group of folks out there. One thing led to another. I got behind the wheel of my car, and I blacked out. When I came to, I saw 2 feet at the top of my windshield and heard the top of my car caving in. And I just kept going. I left and I took off. My girlfriend was in the car with me at the time. She's screaming hysterically. could tell me to stop the car, stop the car, stop the car. And I just took off and I kept driving. And I ended up going home, waking my parents up. I told them what happened. And my dad took me to the precinct so I could turn myself in. And I was arrested that night for malicious wounding. The cops had already been up on the scene and stuff, and the ambulance had came and taken the guy away and everything else. And so the detective shows up and they arrest me that night for malicious wounding. And that was November 6th. November 8th is my parents' wedding anniversary. And November 8th, they came and got me out of my cell and they brought me back down in front of the magistrate and they charged me with first degree murder because a guy died in the hospital. And I'm sitting there, 18 years old, just graduated high school and facing 20 years of life in the penitentiary. And that wasn't part of the cards. Like that was not one of the cards in the deck for my life, I can tell you. But here I am. So I sat in there for a long, not a long time, for a little over a month. And my dad borrowed a lot of money to hire me a lawyer to get a bond hearing. And we got the bond hearing, got the bond. He borrowed a lot of money to bond me out. And while I was out on bond, my lawyer suggested I not drink and I not drive at all while I was out on bond. And I had been in there long enough, my head was clear enough to agree with those recommendations 100%. So I smoked a lot of weed when I got out, and I drank a lot of Old Doul's. And I don't know about you, but if you're still hanging around the bars, hanging around your friends, and everybody's drinking, they're having a great time, they're loosened up, and you know that that's happening because of what they're drinking, and you're drinking Old Doul's, like it's like I mean, literally, like trying to get some sort of effect. I'm like chugging these things, trying to get something. And I'm just all bottled up, and I feel like I'm ready to explode. And that's the way I felt. So I managed to get by for a couple of weeks after I got out, but inevitably, the insane idea won out, and I took pick up a drink again. And my thought process at that time was, screw it, I'm going away for a long time anyway. I may as well have fun while I'm here and do what I want to do. And somehow I managed not to get myself into any more trouble over the next, I think I was out for like 10 months. I was out on bond for 10 months until I went to trial. And I went to one AA meeting during that time, and I remember reading the steps and the traditions. And if you look at those things, man, like none of them say anything about not drinking. Because I thought, if I could just stop drinking, And they didn't say anything about not drinking, and they had that little three-letter word in there. And what I remember about that meeting was I remember one guy, and I'm sure there was probably some good shares in that meeting, but the only one I remember is one man talking about losing his wife, losing his job, losing his kids, losing his house, losing all of his possessions. And I never lost a wife, I never lost any kids, I never lost a house. I did have, I lost my car. I was in the accident. I couldn't drive the car anymore. But that I just chalked that up to, And I left that meeting, and I remember thinking to myself, my mom had taken me to that meeting, and I told her, I said, I'm not that bad. I don't need this. I can do it by myself, And I wasn't ready to quit drinking. I just wasn't done yet. So I ended up going to trial, took a jury trial, and the jury came back and found me guilty of second degree murder. And they gave me the minimum sentence that you can get in the state of Virginia. And do just based off of just based off like not just the evidence, but during the sentencing phase, some character witnesses that I had testify and stuff. Like one of the jurors came up to my family, waited outside the courthouse for my family. One of the jurors came up to my family and apologized for even finding me guilty. But it was too late at that point. Now, I committed my crime in 1994. Virginia abolished parole January 1st of 1995, which meant I was under the old law, which meant that I only had to do 50% at that time. So I got a 5-year sentence. You do the math. When they took me out of that courtroom in handcuffs and shackles, and I turn around and my family, my friends are crying. My mother is crying hysterically. She had a nervous breakdown right there in the courtroom. And I don't understand why everybody's upset. I can't comprehend why everyone is so upset. I wanted to do cartwheels out of that courtroom. Yeah, it sucks. I got to go to the penitentiary, but man, 2.5 years and I'm home. That sure does beat any time period between 20 to life, if you're in my shoes. So during that time I was out on bond, I traveled to visit some family because I didn't know how long I was be gone or if I'd ever see them again. And one of the family members I visited was that same aunt I used to go to church with, my aunt and uncle, and they had moved out to West Virginia. My uncle had bought some property out there back in the 80s, and he built a house up there. And I went out there, and when I got out there, my aunt said, "Jeremy, will you pray with me?" And I wasn't big into prayer and all that stuff, and I was like, "Sure, I'll pray with you." And we go outside, we stand out there on the side of the mountain. The moon is out, and the stars are out. It's a crystal clear night. I mean, like, it's so bright. And we hold hands, and she starts speaking in tongues. And I'm thinking to myself, this, you know, like, I mean, I love my Aunt Linda. She's just crazy, like just a religious fanatic. And she starts talking to me, and she says, "Jeremy, God told me to tell you not to worry. You're not going to have to go away for a long time." And what I remember thinking was, that's good that God told you that, Aunt Linda. And I don't know what y'all's definition of a long time is, but anywhere between 20 to life is a very long time to me. And then I fast forward a couple of months when I go to trial and I get the minimum sentence in the state of Virginia for my crime. And I only have to do 50% of that, which was 2.5 years. And I didn't see that at that time. I didn't see that until I came in Alcoholics Anonymous and started to want to develop, become willing to develop a relationship with this power that I always believed that was out there. I would go sit down on the beach. I grew up in Virginia Beach, and I would go sit out on the beach sometimes at nighttime and listen to the waves crash and the moon and the stars shining down on the water. And I'd always sit out there and I would always pray and I'd always talk to whatever was out there. A lot of it was wallowing in self-pity, why me, poor me stuff. But the fact that I was there talking to something, I've always believed in something. And that was some very powerful evidence that there was something working in my life. And that was something that I could hold on to when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I started to look for those little incidences throughout my life and my drinking where God showed up. And that was one of the most powerful ones that I could see. So I go to prison and I do my time. I go in there with good intentions. Go in there, keep my nose clean, do the right thing, and get out, right? Nope. That lasted for a couple months. And I met this guy. And he's like, "You want to make some mash?" I said, "Yes, absolutely. I want to make some mash." So we put down a batch. He taught me how to do it. And we put down a batch and we got drunk. And another guy, Pete, his girlfriend or his wife, whoever, used to bring him in some other stuff. And we had a little 4th of July party in there one time. And that kind of set things off for me again. I'm back to the races and I'm drinking and I'm smoking and selling dope. And, got involved with this guy and some racketeering stuff in there. And, just doing everything that I wasn't supposed to be doing. And somehow managed to squeeze by in there. I only got two new infractions when I was in there. I think I had to serve an extra 15 days. Not a big deal. I got out. And I got out, and my mom picked me up. And my parents picked me up and stuff. And went back, and I didn't drink the day I got out, but I couldn't wait. I could not wait to meet up with my friends, my buddies, the next day after I got out. And I was off to the races again, and I started drinking, and I drank like I never stopped. And I drank, it was, it really ramped up pretty quick. And I caught myself, like I said, I'm drinking a lot, like I need to calm down. So I started dating this woman that was 17 years older than I was, and she had three kids. And I thought, this is what I need to calm down. I need to be a family man. Because, if I'm a family man, I got work, come home and help take care of the house and the kids. I don't have time to be out with the guys drinking and partying all night, So I ripped and roared through their life for the next 13 months until she got sick and tired of that. And during that time, I told you I got introduced to the other substance, before I went. And during that time, I got, I was on parole, and I was a big weed smoker, and I knew I couldn't smoke weed because of how long it stayed in your system. And I had to go see a parole officer. But I did do that other substance when I got out because it, and I could stop doing that 3 days before I had to go. So I knew it would be out of my system. So if I had to take urinalysis, I was going to be all right. And I'd go see my PO, and I'd take urinalysis, and I'd pass, and I'd get out, and I would have to go see him for another month, and I'd do that stuff all over again. And during that time, like it really, it, I just got, I got hooked on that. And for me, that stuff. And I don't know. I'm not big into like studying addiction and stuff like that. I don't I don't know. I'm alcoholic through and through, man. That's it, 100%. That stuff allowed me to drink in a different way. I'll tell you that. Like, it allowed me to have a really good time. But drinking alcohol was always there from start to finish, no matter what. There were a few times I tried not to drink and just do the other stuff, but it never worked. Never, not once. I had to drink. I had to drink alcohol. And so that didn't work out. I got a good job, my first salary job, where I had benefits and vacation and insurance and everything. And I'm a bar drinker. I got in a fight at a bar one night. It was a local bar. I worked in a local restaurant down in Chicks Beach called Chicks Oyster Bar. The guys that owned it were locals to Virginia Beach, born and raised and grew up, and everybody knew them. And I got in a fight at that bar one night and had the cops called on me. I got arrested for assault and battery. Word got back to the owners, and they politely let me go and said they don't want people like me working for them, giving them a bad rep. And I wasn't mad about that. Like, I knew I was in the wrong, and I knew that they deserved better than that. They were good people. And anyway, I had a hard time finding the job over the next couple of months, and I wasn't really looking for anything permanent because I knew I was going to court and I knew I was going to jail for that charge. Like, I just knew it. There was no sense in like trying to find a job when I was had a court date coming up. So anyway, this bar that I used to drink at, I got in a lot of trouble in that bar. I started a lot of trouble in that bar. And this guy, a buddy of mine, was a bouncer there, and he had some plans one night or something, and he had talked to the owner about me filling in for him, and she agreed, and she agreed to allow me to work there and be a bouncer, but I wasn't allowed to drink. And what she figured was that it would keep me out of trouble and keep me from starting trouble in her establishment. And what it did for me was it gave me a lot in my mind. Like, it's not this, mind you, like, I don't think in reality, in real terms. I think in what I believe. And what my mind, what happened, what I believe was that this gave me a license to put my hands on you, And that's exactly what I proceeded to do as a bouncer in that bar. And I did not drink, I can tell you that. I continued to drink. It was controlled a little bit because I had to work, but not much. And at this time, this other stuff that I was doing, like, become a daily thing. And I can't afford, like, buy that stuff every day. So you got to sell it to pay for what you get, right? So I'm getting a half ounce of cocaine every day, every other day. I'm snorting half of it and I'm selling half of it. And I'm drinking around the clock, and I'm up for, 2, 3, 4 days in a row. And lack of sleep will do terrible things to your brain. And at this time, I am experiencing a lot of hallucinations, a lot of delusions, a lot of blackouts. And I've become someone I never imagined I would be. I don't know if any of you ever been down to Virginia Beach. If you go down Shore Drive, kind of Lynn Haven Inlet, that bridge that goes over the Lynn Haven Inlet, the Lesnar Bridge, I don't know, it's 70, 80, 100 feet off the water down there. There's a sign down there that tells you how many people have died in the currents down there. And one night we were walking home from the, we were not home, we were walking this bartender, the bar hung out of this bartender, Donna. We were walking to her place after the bar closed, and me, her, and the bar back, Bobby Ray. And I got the bright idea, I want to hang this guy over this bridge. And I did that. And this guy was terrified. He was almost in tears. But I did this just so I could get my kicks, just for fun and giggles. And that's just the kind of person I'd become, man. I had absolutely no regard for human life. And it didn't matter if you were a man, woman, or child. If you stepped in front of me, you were going to get physically attacked or something. It just didn't matter. There was no filter. And so I lost that. I go to jail for that assault charge. I get out, and my brother picks me up the morning I get out of right across the street at 7-Eleven, bought a six pack, started drinking. He had the other stuff laid out for me. I started that stuff, and I'm off to the races. I mean, the moment I walked out of that facility, man, it was just like that, instantaneous. It was absolutely no thought at all while I was in there of doing anything different when I got out. None whatsoever. And I ended up going back down there to Chicks Beach, and over the next 4.5 months, my drinking spiral, like, it was spiraled out of control. I think it was already out of control, but it got worse. I tried to control my drinking a lot of different ways, not hanging around this bar, just hanging at that one, not hanging around this guy. Because if I'm with this guy, Chris, like the two of us are exactly alike. And anytime Chris and I are out, there's going to be problems and everybody knows it. Like somebody, there's going to be a fight and somebody's probably going to arrest him. So I try not to go out with him sometimes. I try just drinking beer and not drinking liquor. I did try to quit one time. I never wanted to quit entirely for the rest of my life. I just want to quit long enough to get the heat off and get my life back on track. And the longest I made it 20 days one time. Made it 20 days. And then the next time that I tried, last time that I tried, I don't think I made it a week. And and got a little stir crazy, sitting around the apartment just smoking weed and going to work, a little restless, irritable, discontent. Decided to, one of the bars we hung out on Wednesday nights, 5150, they had power hour, 50-cent well drinks from 7 to 8. And I was there. I was a manager at the restaurant I worked at, and I did the schedule, so I made sure I had every Wednesday night off. That was my one night a week, but that was mine. The one day a week I didn't work, and to make sure I could be there. And I was always there, so I decided to go up there just to hang out and shoot some pool one night on Wednesday. And I hadn't drank in, almost a week, I guess. But I was so angry in there. I was so angry, and I started drinking. And I drank with such a vengeance, and I could not get drunk. I mean, I was chugging shots, mixed drinks, beers, whatever, for hours. Could not get drunk. My brother and I and that guy Chris, my friend Chris, we decided we're going to go to the pool hall, the same pool hall that I hit the guy at. And we go to the pool hall. And as soon as we walk in, they recognize me. Same manager works there. Same manager works there. And immediately, within about 2 to 3 minutes of us walking in the door, we are immediately escorted outside. And that manager, is a whole group of them came outside, and that manager came outside. And I was walking out into my brother's truck. I was driving, and I said, "Come on out here. I'll make sure I put your fat, 6 feet deep this time." And we got in the truck and took off. And a friend of mine told me a few days later that the cops were looking for me. There was warrants out for my arrest. So I went down to turn myself in, and I had trespassing and threatening bodily harm charges. I got bonded out. I've been bonded out for a couple of weeks. My brother and I had this apartment. We've been given an eviction notice. We had 30 days to find somewhere to live, and had about 2 weeks left on that eviction notice. And at that point, September, at that point in my drinking, my alarm clock would go off at 9 o'clock in the morning. That meant it was time for me to stop doing what I was doing and go get ready for work. I had to be at work at 10. My ride was coming at 9:30 to take me to work. And I would go in the bathroom and look at myself in the mirror and say, "Jeremy, what are you doing?" Because I couldn't stand the sight of who was looking back at me. I had no idea who that was. I literally could see my life spiraling out of control. I had absolutely no idea how to stop it or what to do about it. I didn't know who to, I mean, I just didn't know what to do. And I just keep doing what I was doing. I was at 7-Eleven every single morning at 6 a.m., wait for them to unlock the beer coolers. Every single morning at 6 a.m. And I would do that for 2, 3, 4 days straight, round the clock. And my body would physically shut down. I'd sleep for 4 to 6 hours. I'd get up and I'd start all over again. And Sunday, September 17th, was no different. I was at 7-Eleven that morning at 6 a.m., 8 a.m., and 10 a.m. By 1 p.m., I was sitting at Chicks Beach Cafe having some drinks. By 3 p.m., I was in a cage. And this time I was arrested for assault and battery and maliciously launching a missile into a moving vehicle. And at this point, I felt rescued. When they took me in, I literally felt rescued because I had absolutely nowhere to go. Nobody would allow me to spend one night on their couch. Even the guys that I drank with, people that had their own places, a few that had, like when I was so unpredictable. I mean, I would physically assault my brother, my best friend. Like, it didn't matter. Women, kids sitting on a curb in front of a 7-Eleven one night, and I was so out of my mind. And I was going up there to meet somebody to pick something up. And I perceived this kid to be looking at me funny in a threatening manner. And I walked up to him, put my cigarette on his face, and said, "Why are you looking at me?" Like, it just didn't matter. I was so screwed up. And when I went in there, I figured with my record, I'm going to serve at least 5 years, and I was perfectly okay with that. I was perfectly okay because I figured that I needed the time to get myself straight and come up with a plan for my life. God
Yeah.
knows I need a plan for my life. God knows I need it more than that, not my plan. I needed his plan. So I go in, I have a bunch of court dates, I got a bunch of charges, I got a bunch of parole violations, and I'm facing another felony now. I got misdemeanors. And I go to all my court dates. I get sentenced. I was only facing 13 years this time, like not a big deal. I get 8 years, I get all of it suspended except for a year and a half. I got one court date left for a violation. And they came and got me out of general population. They put me in a therapeutic community program in this facility. Now, to be in this program, you have to be sentenced by the judge. You have to be. There's no volunteering or asking. That's sentenced only. So I'm like, I didn't ask to go there. I don't want to go there. They're like, well, I'll tell the counselor. It's like, all right. So the next day, the counselor comes in. And there's like 16 of us in this pod, and calls everybody out of cell one by one. He goes through these stack of envelopes that he has one by one. He gets through all the envelopes. He has no more envelopes. He looks around. He looks at me. My cell's right in front of the table. He's sitting there. He's like, who are you? I have your paperwork for you. I said, well, I didn't ask to be here. He said, I got one spot open. You want to stay or you want to go? I said, well, I think I'll stay because I think I got a problem. And from that moment on, I started my journey here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd had enough. I just had enough. And I didn't plan that. Like, I didn't plan on not drinking anymore. I didn't plan on going to AA or getting treatment at that point. I remember when I went in there and I got arrested, I called my mom and I'm talking to her. I was ready to quit doing all the drugs I was doing. It was the crystal meth and the cocaine that was really messing me up. And she said, what about drinking? And I said, I don't know. I was 24 years old. Couldn't imagine going the rest of my life without drinking. And I don't remember much of that conversation. I remember getting mad at my mom. And I remember telling my mom, I guess this is just how the rest of my life is going to be spent. And I had a really, really clear picture in my mind at that time. No matter how long I was alive, I didn't plan on living past the age of 30. And no matter how many of those years I was alive, I was going to be in and out of a correctional center. I was 24 years old, incarcerated for the third time already. I just knew it. Like it was just there. And I got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got introduced to the Big Book and all the AA literature. And I don't know why or for what reason, what changed. But I was willing to do whatever it takes. I mean, I'm sitting in there, I have a sponsor, I'm not taking steps, so I'm reading that book every single day. I'm practicing prayer and meditation, going to meetings. We have groups, we have AA meetings, we have groups every day, and the volunteers come in once a week and bring an AA meeting in, and just listening to those guys come in. And one guy, Bill Campbell, he always stood at the door, and some of y'all do corrections, y'all know what the smell is like in there. Not just in the atmosphere, not necessarily like, well, it is. It's coming from the guys or the gals, whatever. It's just there. But this man stood at that door every single Thursday he was there. And he always had these very, very soft eyes, very soft smile, very soft spoken. And he always gave me a hug and he always told me he loved me. And Bill sat beside me that Thursday night in that facility, and Bill celebrated 20 years sober. And I remember thinking to myself, why is he in here with us? Celebrating 20 years sober. Why is he not out there at a real AA meeting showing everybody that he's 20 years sober? Because that's where I would be. I want to show you how wonderful I am. That's where my mind's at. What I know today is Bill had more humility in his pinky than I'll probably ever have in my life. Bill's so 40 some years sober today. The next year, on Bill's 21st anniversary, I was able to be at his home group. The Monday night Indian River 12 and 12, and I was able to sit in a circle of about 100 people and watch Bill get up and get his 21-year medallion. And I can't tell you, I just can't describe to you the look on some of those guys' faces in that group when they saw me come to that meeting on the outside. I mean, you talk about a smile and just somebody's face lighting up. And I didn't understand that at the time. I get it today because I do a lot of corrections work and I get to see guys come out and show up and participate and stay sober. And I kept coming back. I got a sponsor within a few weeks, and my sponsor said, I got rules. Can you follow rules? I said, yes. So there's the first lie. Obviously, I don't follow rules very well, but I followed his rules. I did everything he told me to do exactly. He said, you're to go to a minimum of five meetings a week. You're to get on your knees and pray in the morning and get on your knees and pray at night. You're to call me every single day at 5:30. You're to get a home group. You're to read the big book, read the doctor's opinion every single day for 30 days. He said, do you have a dictionary? I said, no. He said, get one. You're going to need it. He underlined a bunch of words in the doctor's opinion. He said, look the words up in the dictionary, write the definitions out on a sheet of paper. He said, when you're read, as you're reading, you get to one of those words, stop, read the definition so you understand what it is you're reading. I said, okay. I did exactly that. I did exactly what he said. I didn't have a cell phone at the time. I lived with my mother, and my mother allowed me to live with her, provided I stay sober. And my brother ended up coming to live with us. My sister ended up coming to live with us. We're all jammed in this little house. And we got one landline, and so everybody, wants to make phone calls and stuff. And I'm like, hey, 5:30, I've got to have the phone no matter what. I don't care who you're talking to, 5:30. Like it was important, like it was paramount. So there were times I'd call my sponsor at 5:31. I was lucky enough he answered the phone. He would answer the phone, you're late at 5:31. What that taught me was respect for other people's time. Because what I have today, the most valuable thing that I have in my life is my time. It's what I choose to do with my time today. And that's what that man taught me. Not only did he want to see the willingness on my end, willing to go to any lengths, what I was willing to do, but he wanted to see that follow through. And he taught me valuable lessons through those simple instructions that he gave me early on in the beginning. And we met every week. We went through the 12 steps out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I asked him about reading the other book. He said, I can't tell you what to read and what not to read. He said, but I suggest you wait until we get through the 12 steps out of the big book, and then you can go read that other book if you want. He said, because the directions on these steps are right here outlined in our big book. So that's what I did. I wrote a fourth step, did my fifth step with him, he got me started on making amends. And naturally I got involved in a relationship way too soon, because because I'm lonely, because I need a connection, and I rely on all these human powers and these, outside, anything outside of God. Like anything, that's going to give me some sort of comfort on the inside. And I've always relied on relationships, women, money, spending money, material. I told you I'm very materialistic, like all those things to give me some sort of ease and comfort on the inside. The problem is it's short-lived. It doesn't last that long. And then I want something else. Ed Mutum used to say, he was attracted to bright, shiny things. It's like all of a sudden you're like, I'm zeroed in. I'm like, right on point, and all of a sudden something bright and shiny flies by. It's like, whoa, it's like, whether it's the mini skirt or whether it's the nice flashy car, whatever it is, like it takes my attention, and that's it. And if I'm not staying focused on here and Alcoholics Anonymous doing what I'm supposed to do. And I got involved, I started making amends and paying money back. I was told it's not your money, you got to pay the money back. So I took my time with a lot of that stuff, because I got out, man. Like my grand sponsor told me, he said, get a bad, he's like, get a job. He said, get a bad job. I don't care. Just get a job. I took a job making $7 an hour because it's what I could get. But what he told me was a paycheck is better than no paycheck, And I had that job. I got a small little raise within 90 days, and it was in a restaurant. And I was hanging out with my sponsor one day. I was off, I was at my sponsor's house, and one of his other sponsees called, and they were talking, and one thing led to another, and the company he was with was hiring. And I went up there, and he had talked to the owner. And, I went in, I was honest on the application. I was honest with the owner during the interview. I told him my whole history, my background, and he believed in giving people second chances. And they taught me a trade. They taught me how to weld. They taught me how to work on tractor trailers, container depots, cargo containers, and the chassis they carry them on. And I became a trailer mechanic. And I loved welding so much. I went to TCC, and I took the welding school and became a certified welder. Something about fire and demolition, man, just like melting metal and stuff and putting it together is like really. I set a field on fire when I was like 8 one time. Fire's always been just fascinating to me. My dad, my natural dad, he was in the fire department, and I don't know, it must run in the blood. But anyway, so I'm working at this company, and I'm staying sober. I'm doing what I'm supposed to do, and really active in service work right from the get-go. I couldn't do corrections at that time. I could get clearance anywhere. And then I met a woman up in Richmond. I'm down in Portsmouth at this time, and coming up to Richmond a little bit, doing some things in AA. And I met a woman up in Richmond, and we started dating and did the long distance things for a couple of years. I ended up moving to Richmond with her, and that didn't work out. And mostly my responsibility for it not working out. I struggled a lot with untreated alcoholism at 10, 11 years sober. And just a lot of factors involved with that. And I did the best that I could at the time, and but I came out of that learning a lot about myself, learning a lot about God, learning a lot about relationships, learning a lot about character defects. And anyway, so I finally did get involved in corrections work, and that's one of my favorite things to do today. And I started a meeting at a facility out in Nottoway 10 years ago. Me and a couple other guys were asked to go to a 12-step workshop down in Lunenburg. And one of the AA volunteers down there, this lady, she was taking a meeting in Lunenburg. She was on the staff at this facility called VCBR, Virginia Center for Behavioral Rehabilitation. And what this facility is it houses all violent sex offenders. They're finished with their state time. They have no state time. They go to this facility for treatment, and they're in here for an indeterminate amount of time. Now, they don't have a release date. They have to go in front of the judge and be deemed fit for society to get out of this facility. A lot of those guys will never see the light of day, never see their freedom again, and they don't know it. Some of them do, but some of them don't. You talk about hopeless. Talk about hopeless. I was asked to go over there and bring a meeting in there. I had a lot going on at that time. And I told the lady, I said, I'll come down once a month. And I said, I can come down once a month until I find some AA folks in that community to kind of take it over and get it going. And there's just nobody down there that's willing to go into that facility because of what that facility is. And I went down there the first time, and I didn't stop. I went down every single Monday. I didn't stop. My absolute favorite meeting. That meeting, we had 20, 25 guys every single week in that meeting. When I started that meeting, I told them, I said, I don't care why you're in here. Nobody asked me what my background was when I came and sat beside you in Alcoholics Anonymous. You never asked me, hey, have you ever killed anybody? You didn't ask me that. You gave me a seat. You gave me a cup of coffee. You welcomed me. You gave me a hug. You said, we're here to help you if you want to do something about your drinking. And you reached out and you allowed me to be here with you. And that's exactly what I taught those guys. That's exactly what I showed them. I said, this is what we're going to do. This is y'all's group. This is y'all's meeting, not mine. And I walked them through the whole voting process. They voted to set up their meeting exactly how they wanted it. The format, the prayers, everything. Down, we got chips in there. We had coffee going at one time, and people in other groups started getting jealous and complaining. So they took the coffee away from us. Still got a little resentment about that, you know. But I tell you, man, I've met a group of wonderful men in that facility, and I help a group of wonderful men today in Richmond that have come out of that facility, and I've watched their lives transform on the outside. I've watched their lives transform on the outside. I go pick three of those guys up every single Sunday morning. I take them to a meeting. We talk about Alcoholics Anonymous. We talk about living a sober life, you know. And when real quick, I'll give you just a short snippet of what's happened to me to get me where I'm at today. I met my wife in Richmond. We got married. I never wanted to be married, never wanted to have kids. I got married. I have a 7-year-old son today. He's absolutely the best thing in my life. Aside from my sobriety, is absolutely number one, the best thing that's happened to me since being sober. And I'm glad I did not allow that fear to dominate me the rest of my life. And my wife has some health issues. She's very high risk, and during the pregnancy, almost lost both of them. They both almost died right there. And all I could do was sit there and hold my little son's hand. And once he was born and out, and they put him over on a little table, and all the doctors are around my wife, making sure she's trying to do. She has a heart disease, and they're doing what they got to do to make sure she survived. And I stood over there with my little son, and I just told him, everything's going to be okay, buddy. God's going to take care of mommy. It's going to be okay, because God knows I can't raise that boy alone. God knows he needs his mother. And they're both very, healthy, and she's as healthy as she can be with her stuff. But my son is healthy and very active in sports, and just a really overall good kid. And then COVID happened. And everything shut down. And I don't blame COVID for this, because I failed to do what I was supposed to do. And one thing led to another over time. I can't stand Zoom meetings. I need to be face to face. I need human connection. And things started to pile up, and I wasn't being honest with my sponsor, and I wasn't being honest with God, and I wasn't doing an honest inventory. And I stepped out on my wife, and one thing led to another. Here we are, and I'm in the middle of a divorce now, and staying with a friend, and I don't know what's going to happen. I'm in a very, very dark place, but the one thing that I remain to have is hope. I've had nothing but love, from friends in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have not, had nothing but arms extended out to me saying, we're right here with you. It's okay. You're going to be okay. No matter what, no matter how hard or what the struggles are, Alcoholics Anonymous has always been there for me. And I believe that that's God. I believe that my God works through you to come to me. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.